Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in the very last half of the last chapter of the book of 1 Kings, verses 29 through 33. I'm going to call this section of scripture Ahab to Ahaziah in the north, Jehoshaphat in the south. Our context is this: in the first half of chapter 22 of 1 Kings, verses 1 through 28, in our last audio, we see Ahab being encouraged to go fight the fatal battle of Ramoth-Gilead by 400 prophets of Baal. Probably prophets of Baal. You're going to win, Ahab. And then Micaiah, the godly Yahweh prophet, says, no, you're not, Ahab. You're going to die. So Ahab throws Micaiah in jail. So we'll see who's right, Ahab or Micaiah. Spoiler alert, it was Micaiah. Ahab's going to get killed in this section of scripture. So we start now in 1 Kings 22, verses 29 through 30. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went up against Ramoth-Gilead. The king of Israel is Ahab. The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and go into the battle, but you put on your robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself and went into the battle. Now, in our last audio, I told you where Ramoth-Gilead was, about 24 miles from Samaria. Gil says it's across the Jordan River in the Trans-Jordan area. You go about 10 miles south of the Sea of Galilee and then go to a wadi there that goes due east. Go down that wadi for about 10 miles. You hit Jabesh-Gilead, which is the famous place where Saul had his bones buried by the elders of Gilead, who took them down from the walls of Bethshan. And then you go north of Jabesh-Gilead, but I think it's about 20 miles or so northeast. You hit the king's highway, and there's Ramoth-Gilead. South of the king's of Ramoth-Gilead on the king's highway is present-day Ammon. Ammon, as they called it. Well, it even pronounced the same. At least I pronounce it the same. Ammon in the south, and then if you go north from Ramoth-Gilead, eventually you get to Damascus. So it was on a trade route. It was a very important place. Our time frame here is Ahab reigned from 874 to 853 B.C. Jehoshaphat ruled from 870 to 848 B.C. So you see they're roughly contemporaneous for most of their reigns. They knew who their opposing king was very well. In fact, they had a marriage alliance. And so Jehoshaphat, the marriage alliance was Ahab's daughter Athaliah married Jehoshaphat's son Jehoram. And so as they're getting ready to go to battle at Ramoth-Gilead, Ahab suggests to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself. You put on your robes, your kingly robes, your royal robes. Now, Jehoshaphat has agreed to go here. Why did he agree to go? There were 400 prophets. Sounded like they were prophesying in the name of the Lord. Might be one reason he did. There was only one prophet prophesying against it. Another reason Jehoshaphat might have thought it was safe is because Micaiah had prophesied, evil of Ahab only in the last chapter, but not of Jehoshaphat. Micaiah said the Lord had proclaimed disaster against Ahab, but no mention of Jehoshaphat. Well, I don't think that's a good reason for Jehoshaphat to want to go, because a disaster for King Ahab is going to be a disaster for Ahab's ally, Jehoshaphat. So I don't think that Jehoshaphat thought of that as a reason that he should go up against Ramoth-Gilead. I think more likely is that Jehoshaphat had given his word previously to Ahab. They were in an alliance, a marriage alliance even. And also, Ahab's cause was just. The city of Ramoth-Gilead was one of the Levitical cities of Israel. It belonged to Israel. And so, Jehoshaphat swallowed any reservations he had about this battle, and he had them, as we saw in the last audio. That's why he called for Micaiah, to get a 401st opinion. But Micaiah's words didn't stop Jehoshaphat, and so Jehoshaphat went on to Ramoth-Gilead with Ahab. Now, in verse 30, Ahab disguises himself as an ordinary soldier. Why did he do that? Well, he was trying to avoid Micaiah's prophecy that disaster would fall on Ahab, and he wanted to avoid that. He figures, well, if I hide, then Ben-Hadad II's not going to know who I am, and so he won't kill me. Here's what Ellicott says, quote, the precaution of Ahab is almost ludicrously characteristic of his temper of half-belief and half-unbelief. In itself, it is, of course, plainly absurd to believe that God's judgment has in all probability been pronounced, and yet to suppose that it can be averted by so puerile a precaution. He had a prophecy from Micaiah, and he thinks he's going to get out of it by disguising himself? Now, on Ahab's behalf, We might can speculate that perhaps deserters or spies had told Ahab that Ben-Hadad intended on killing him. Now, we don't know that, but we do know in verse 31 that Ben-Hadad had commanded the 32 captains of his chariots, saying, "Do not fight with small or great, but with the king of Israel alone." So Ahab has been fingered. Now, whether he knew it or not, we don't know, but it could be that deserters from Ben-Hadad's army or spies sent out by Ahab had told him that Ben-Hadad II was going to nail him if he could, and so he's trying to protect himself. Barnes speculates that Ahab had indeed probably heard of Ben-Hadad's order to kill Ahab, his order to his captains to go after Ahab. The commentator Benson says that it's possible Ben-Hadad II only wanted to imprison Ahab. Well, Ellicott thinks lowly of Ahab, saying it's stupid to avoid a prophecy. Colin Delitzsch has a higher opinion of Ahab. They say, quote, "There is no ground for detecting any cunning vanities on the part of Ahab in these words, as some of the older commentators have done, as though he wished thereby to divert the predicted evil from himself to Jehoshaphat. But we may see very clearly that Ahab had good reason to be anxious about his life, from the command of the Syrian king to the captains of his war chariots, to fight chiefly against the king of Israel." That's in the verse I just read, the next verse, 31. Colin Delitzsch continue, "We cannot infer from this, however, that Ahab was aware of the command." That's a speculation. "The measure adopted by him may be sufficiently accounted for from his fear of the fulfillment of Micah's evil prophecy, to which there may possibly have been added some personal offense that had been given on his part to the Syrian king in connection with the negotiations concerning the surrender of Ramoth, which had no doubt preceded the war." Well, that's speculation, speculation, speculation. So even if Ahab didn't know that Ben-Hadad II was fingering him particularly, Ahab did know that Micaiah had made an evil prophecy against him, that disaster was coming on him. And so he's probably figuring, "I'm going to get out of this." So he tells Jehoshaphat to put on your robes, it says. Now, Adam Clark says it's a question of whether it was Jehoshaphat's robes or Ahab's robes that Jehoshaphat was going to wear. I don't think it really matters. The point is that Jehoshaphat in battle is going to be very much distinguished from King Ahab, who is going to look like an ordinary soldier. Now, for Jehoshaphat to wear his kingly robes in battle while Ahab did not, that certainly seemed dishonorable from Jehoshaphat's point of view. Why did he agree to look like Ahab? Why did he agree to be a lightning rod for an enemy arrow? Well, here's some speculations. It could be that Jehoshaphat knew that the king of Syria, Ben-Hadad II, was really only angry at Ahab and not by Jehoshaphat. The Cambridge Commentary agrees and says this, quote, "He, Jehoshaphat, will therefore clothe himself like an ordinary soldier and let the king of Judah alone appear in kingly robes." Excuse me, he, Ahab, will therefore clothe himself like an ordinary soldier and let the king of Judah alone, Jehoshaphat alone, appear in kingly robes. For against Jehoshaphat, the attack would not be particularly directed. Well, I don't buy that, because if I'm Jehoshaphat, why would I expect an enemy to treat an ally of Ahab any different than Ahab himself? I think the commentator Benson has a better idea as to why Jehoshaphat did this. Jehoshaphat took it as an honor to lead the army. He's in charge. He's wearing the kingly robes, and you know how these kings loved honor and glory and war. Ahab's not going to get any glory hiding like a common soldier, but Jehoshaphat's going to get it all. I think that makes a lot of sense. Colin Delitzsch softened these words of Ahab, where Ahab says, "You put on your robes." It sounds like a command. Well, you're not going to command a king. And in fact, Colin Delitzsch say it was only a suggestion, not a command. Quote, "These words are not to be taken as a command, but simply in this sense. Thou mayest, thou canst, put on thy royal dress, since there is no necessity for thee to take any such precautions as I have to take." I love how these commentators talk in King James English, even when they're not quoting the King James Bible. In other words, Colin Delitzsch say that Ahab just said, "Hey, Jehoshaphat, if you want to, you could take some heat off of me, and you'll get some glory in it, too, if you'll do that." And so that explains why Jehoshaphat wore the robes. So we go now to 1 Kings 22, verses 31 through 33. "Now the king of Aram," that's Syria, that's Ben-Hadad II, "had commanded the 32 captains of his chariots, saying, 'Do not fight with small or great, but with the king of Israel alone.' So when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, they said, 'Surely it is the king of Israel.' and they turned aside to fight against him. And Jehoshaphat cried out. When the captains of the chariot saw that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. Now in verse 31, Ben-Hadad II has commanded his 32 captains of his chariots to go particularly after Ahab. Why did he do that? Well, here's the first option. If Ahab is taken, Ahab's army would quickly disband and surrender. You want to kill the snake, you kill the head. That makes a lot of sense. It could be because of personal spite, because Ahab had attacked him. Remember, this is an offensive war. Ben-Hadad II is on the defense here. Barnes suggests that perhaps Ben-Hadad II wanted to wipe out the stain of his humiliating two previous defeats. That was in chapter 20, the siege of Samaria. Ben-Hadad II got whooped. And then the next campaigning season after winter had passed at a place called Aphek, Ben-Hadad II had gotten whooped again by Ahab. And so maybe Ben-Hadad II was just tired of this. He says, we're going to get him. Revenge, it could be. It could be for both reasons. Get Ahab, the army will surrender, and plus I get to expunge some of my feelings of revenge. Well, as Barnes points out, Ben-Hadad II is showing small appreciation of Ahab's previous generosity of letting him go. Ahab let Ben-Hadad II go after the Battle of Aphek, and he was reproved by an unnamed prophet for letting him go. I think the penalty for letting him go was something like, you're going to die. This unnamed prophet in 1 Kings 20, verse 42 said, because you released from your hand Ben-Hadad II, and I'd already set Ben-Hadad II for destruction, it will be your life in place of his life. In other words, you're going to die. And it will be your people, that's the people of northern Israel, in place of his people. In other words, you're going to die instead of him, and the people of Israel are going to die instead of Ben-Hadad II. So Ahab had really done Ben-Hadad II a favor. Of course, he didn't mean to subject himself to a death sentence, but he did. And Ben-Hadad II, nonetheless, says, I'm going to go after you, Ahab. You know, they hated each other, so what else is new? So verse 31, the king of Aram had commanded 32 captains of his chariots. That's the same number as the number of kings or kinglets who were in Ben-Hadad II's first battle with Israel, 1 Kings chapter 20, verse 1. Now Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, assembled his entire army. 32 kings, along with horses and chariots, were with him. He marched up, besieged Samaria, and fought against it. Now these little kings were kings of little principalities that were scattered around in the Syrian desert, and they were all allied together under Ben-Hadad. There were also 32 captains in the second battle at Aphek, 1 Kings 20, verse 24. Also do this. This is Ben-Hadad II talking to his people. Remove each king from his position, bye-bye 32 kings, and appoint captains in their place. Ben-Hadad II was not content with the king's earlier performance. And so we now have, it's probably the same 32 chariot commanders here, the 32 military commanders who were supposed to go after Ahab. And notice his chariots. Ahab's going to get killed in a chariot. So this is a chariot battle at Ramoth-Gilead. Now in verse 32, when Jehoshaphat is attacked by the captains of the chariots, he cried out. And they said, surely it's the king of Israel. They said that before Jehoshaphat cried out. Turned out it was the king of Judah. Now this crying out, what was it? Was it to the 32 captains to let them know that Jehoshaphat was not Ahab? I think that's exactly what it was. It could be he cried out to his own men to come to his assistance. Well, maybe so. It could be he cried out to God for help. 2 Chronicles 18:31. So when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, they said, it is the king of Israel, and they turned aside to fight against him. In other words, they thought it was Ahab, the king of Israel. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him, and God diverted them from him. So it sounds like there he's crying out to God. It could be all three, actually. He's crying out to everybody, hey, I am Jehoshaphat. I'm not Ahab. Lay off. At the same time he's saying that, of course, his men are going to come to his assistance, and he's saying, oh, Yahweh, please help me. Barnes speculates that when Jehoshaphat cried out, that perhaps Jehoshaphat was using his own special battle cry, which might have been known to the Syrians. And then, of course, when he uses his own battle cry known to the Syrians would know, hey, we got the wrong guy. This is not Ahab, king of Israel. Well, that's highly speculative. I just think he cried out to his people to come help him. So the captains of Ben-Hadad II's chariots turned back in verse 33, because their orders were to go after Ahab. So we go now to 1 Kings 22, verses 34 through 36. Now a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel in a joint of the armor. So he said, that's Ahab, said to the driver of his chariot, turn around and take me out of the fight, for I am severely wounded. The battle raged that day, and the king was propped up in his chariot in front of the Arameans and died at evening. And the blood from the wound ran into the bottom of the chariot. Then a cry passed throughout the army close to sunset, saying, every man to his city and every man to his country. End of battle. Now, for an arrow to hit the joint in your armor, now, if you believed in luck, that's some real bad luck. For an arrow to find such a difficult place shows Ahab wasn't living right, which he wasn't. God directed that arrow into the joint of that armor. That's what happened, because he was going to fulfill that prophecy that the unnamed prophet had said, you're going to die for letting Ben-Hadad II live. And sure enough, Ahab let Ben-Hadad II live, and Ben-Hadad II's soldiers killed him, killed Ahab. Now in verse 34, Ahab tells his chariot driver, turn around, take me out of the fight. Ahab probably intended to get the blood flow stopped and then return to the battle. John Gill says it seems he did return to the battle because he was propped up in his chariot, and he didn't die till that evening, and the battle raged the whole day. So apparently he went out of the battle, tried to get his wound dressed, and then went back while he's bleeding. That actually shows a little bit of courage, really, for such a bad man. Why did Ahab's people prop Ahab up in the chariot in front of the Syrians so the Syrians could see him? Well, that was to encourage Ahab's army, and so the Syrians would not know he was wounded. Again, that's pretty courageous. Give the man credit when it's due. Now, Ahab didn't die till evening. The arrow was probably poisoned, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, and they also speculate that the heat of the day probably aggravated the effect of the poison. In other words, it could have been a relatively slight wound, but the poison got him. At any rate, he dies, and that blood ran into the bottom of the chariot, and we're going to see in just a minute that blood is going to be washed out near a prostitute's bathing pool outside the gates of Samaria. We'll see that in just a minute. In verse 36, a cry passed throughout the army, every man to his city, every man to his country. That, of course, fulfills Micaiah's prophecy that was given to Ahab and Jehoshaphat in 1 Kings 22:17, first part of this chapter. So he, Micaiah, said, I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep which have no shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. Let each of them return to his house in peace. So it seems like it was a drawn battle. The Israelites returned to their house in peace, just like Micaiah had speculated. It was an orderly retreat. They weren't routed. They weren't run down and massacred. So Micaiah's words were exactly true. Ahab, you're going to die, or disaster is going to come on your head. Well, Micaiah had said, I see all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep which have no shepherd. There's your hint from Micaiah, or prophecy from Micaiah, that Ahab's going to be dead because Israel now has no shepherd. They have no king. So we go now to 1 Kings 22, verses 37 through 40. So the king died and was brought to Samaria. Samaria, of course, is the capital city of the northern kingdom, right somewhat in the middle of Ephraim, south of Jezreel. And they buried the king in Samaria. They washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. Now the harlots bathed themselves there, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke. Now the rest of the acts of Ahab and all that he did, and the ivory house which he built, and all the cities which he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Ahab slept with his fathers, and Ahaziah his son became king in his place. Ahab reigned from 874 to 853, and Ahaziah his son ruled for 2 years, 853 to 852. Now in verse 38, that would be the soldiers of Ahab, they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria. They probably drove the chariot into the water after Ahab's body was removed from the chariot. That makes sense. And the dogs licked up his blood. Now I have a problem here. How can the dogs lick up the blood? Well, Poole and Benson, those two commentators, say that Ahab's blood had mixed with the water when the chariot was driven into the prostitute's pool. The blood mixed with the water, and then the dogs drank the water. They licked up the water, and they're licking up the blood that's in the water. Well, that makes sense. It could be, this is my speculation, that the dogs got to the chariot while the chariot was unattended before the chariot was pushed into the water. In other words, the soldiers could have pulled Ahab's body out of the chariot, and they're dealing with Ahab's body, And while they're doing that, the chariot's just left sitting there, and then the dogs run up and start licking the blood out of the chariot. I actually prefer my solution rather than pools or Benson's. Now, the pool where Ahab's chariot was washed was also a pool where harlots took baths. Now, why would that little incidental detail be mentioned? Well, it was to show Ahab's ignominious death. In addition to the dogs licking blood, which showed Ahab's ignominious death, also harlots bathing where Ahab's chariot was being cleansed and where Ahab's blood flowed. Ahab's blood was mingled with the same water that prostitutes bathed in. As Ellicott says, dog and harlot are the animal and human types of uncleanness. So it's a poetic touch, I think. According to the word of the Lord which he spoke, these dogs are licking up the blood. Now, there were two words of the Lord prophesied about this. Let's start with the easy prophecy first. That's Micaiah in the first part of chapter 22, which we covered in our last audio. 1 Kings 22:17. So Micaiah said, I saw all Israel scattered on the hills like sheep without a shepherd, and the Lord said, they have no master, let everyone return home in peace. All right, all Israel scattered. They got beat at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead. They were sheep without a shepherd. That's because Ahab got killed. They have no master, let everyone return home in peace. All the soldiers came home without being chased. So that prophecy was fulfilled to the letter, that prophecy of Micaiah. Micaiah also prophesied three verses later in 1 Kings 22:20. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab to march up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? This is Micaiah recounting his vision where he saw the heavenly host seated around God, and God is asking for someone to go down there and entice Ahab to march up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead. Well, that happened. So that shows that Micaiah's vision was fulfilled. 1 Kings 22:28. Same chapter, but Micaiah said, if you ever return safely, Ahab, the Lord has not spoken through me. Well, Ahab didn't return safely, so the Lord did speak through Micaiah. So that was according to the word of the Lord. Ahab got his blood licked up. Well, that was easy enough, but now there's another problem here with Elijah's prophecy being picked up, being fulfilled. And I will tell you right now that this is one humdinger of an exegetical problem. I came up with A through G solutions to it, which shows that nobody's agreed on how to solve the problem. This is a problem that if you want to get a PhD in New Testament exegesis, I welcome you to it. I actually found a Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society article dedicated to this problem, so I'm telling you right now that this is not easy. Well, here's the problem. Elijah, in the last chapter, 1 Kings 21:19, had prophesied that Ahab's blood was to be licked up in the place where Naboth's blood was licked up. Now, Naboth was, of course, the owner of the vineyard that Ahab had stolen and then gotten Naboth judicially murdered, and Naboth was executed outside of Jezreel. His vineyard was within Jezreel, and Ahab's blood, as we're seeing here, was being licked up in Samaria. Well, Samaria is not Jezreel, but Ahab said that, thus says the Lord, 1 Kings 21:19, in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, that's Jezreel, the dogs will lick up your blood. But Ahab's blood was licked up in Samaria, not Jezreel, so there's your problem. Now, I mentioned the problem in the last audio. I'm going to go through this again. I've got solutions A through G. That's 5, 6, 7 possible solutions. So let's start with the first option. Elijah meant the general area the blood of the two characters would be licked up, not a specific place. In other words, Samaria is the same place as Jezreel where Naboth died, and so if you look at it like that, then in the same place, Samaria, Naboth's blood is licked up, and in the same place, Samaria, because Jezreel is a part of the kingdom of Samaria, Naboth's blood's licked up. In other words, Samaria is not referring just to the city of Samaria, but the whole northern kingdom, because Samaria was the capital of it. I think that's somewhat of a stretch, but I guess it's reasonable. Here's option number two. In Samaria, where Ahab's blood was mixed with the water of the prostitute's pool, there was a stream that carried that water and blood all the way down to the waters of Jezreel. And then when Naboth's body was thrown somewhere in Jezreel, it was near that stream, and the dogs drank the water there. That's assumed, because it doesn't say that the dogs did that, but we can assume that. And to me, that is a 5! Humdinger of a, I don't believe that. Option number three. This is what Adam Clark says, and a lot of other commentators too. The prophecy of Elijah was fulfilled in not in the blood of Ahab, but was fulfilled in the blood of Ahab's son Joram. Now, what happened here, way on in the 2 Kings, this is after Ahaziah and Joram, Ahab's second son, is taken over. We read in 2 Kings 9:25-26, Jehu, that's the leader of the next dynasty, said to Bidkar his aide, pick him, pick Joram up, and throw him on the plot of ground belonging to Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember when you and I were riding side by side behind his father Ahab, and the Lord uttered this oracle against him? As surely as I saw the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons yesterday, this is the Lord's declaration, so I will repay you on this plot of land. This is the Lord's declaration. So now, according to the word of the Lord, pick him up and throw him on the plot of land. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, I think Jehu misquoted Elijah, because Elijah just said in the same place. He didn't say on this plot of land. He said in the same place, Naboth's and Ahab's blood was going to be licked up. So here's the idea of this solution, which I'll call Clark's solution. Elijah originally prophesied that Ahab's blood was going to be licked up with Naboth's blood in the same place, but God relented from that judgment on Ahab because of Ahab's repentance, which we see in 1 Kings 21:29. God tells Elijah, have you seen how Ahab has humbled himself before me? I will not bring the disaster during his lifetime because he has humbled himself before me. I will bring the disaster on his house during his son's lifetime. And so the theory is, since Joram was Ahab's son, that's when the disaster came. And so that's when the prophecy was fulfilled, when Joram's blood was spilled, not Ahab's. I got a problem with that. In our text here in verse 38, it says the dogs licked up Ahab's blood according to the word of the Lord which he spoke. The text here refers the word of the Lord straight to Ahab's blood being licked up in Samaria, not Joram's blood being licked up in Jezreel. So I got a problem with that. So let's look at option number 4. Elijah's prophecy in 1 Kings 21:19. Elijah's prophecy says, in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, that in the place should be translated as in like manner as, according to Benson. So we would read Elijah's prophecy this way in 1 Kings 21:19. In like manner as the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, the dogs will lick up your blood. Well, that solves the problem because you take place completely out of the equation here. Of course, that depends on Hebrew translations, and I don't know Hebrew, so I don't know whether that's right or not. Here's option number 6. This is my solution. So you can take that with 1, 2, maybe 3 grains of salt. The blood in Elijah's prophecy refers directly to Joram's blood. In other words, we read it this way, Elijah's prophecy this way. In the place where the dogs licked up the blood, not referring to in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, the dogs will lick up your blood. And blood there is not referring to the blood flowing through Ahab's veins, but is referring to the blood of his descendants. Is he your blood relative? If I say somebody's my blood relative, that doesn't mean that my blood is in my relative. It just means he's related to me. So in your blood means the dogs will lick up your relative's blood, even yours. Now, if my solution might be correct, I would have to assume that place meant Jezreel, not Naboth's vineyard. In that place, in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, that would have to be in the place of public execution outside of Jezreel, not Naboth's vineyard. Jehu thought it was Naboth's vineyard where the prophecy was going to be fulfilled. And like I say, I think he misquoted Elijah, misunderstood him. I have to assume further that Jehu is not worried about in that place being precise. He just figures Jezreel, he doesn't think about it any further than that. Elijah said that in the same place, i.e. in Jezreel, the blood of Ahab is going to be shed, just like Naboth's blood was shed. So in Jezreel, it's going to be shed. And I'm going to put a little cherry on top. I'm going to take the blood of Joram, Ahab's blood, and his son. I'm going to take it. I'm going to put it in Naboth's vineyard for symbolic reasons. So everybody will know this is why Joram died, because his father, Ahab, murdered Naboth. I actually think that's a pretty good solution. But, of course, it's never been vetted or cross-examined by anybody, so, like I say, take it with a grain of salt. Actually, I just vetted it myself as I edited this audio, and I realized my solution's got a big problem, because in 1 Kings 22:38, the text plainly says it was the blood of Ahab that fulfill the word of the Lord, and my solution had the blood of Joram fulfilling Elijah's prophecy. So I guess my solution does not work. Now, I found an interesting article, as I mentioned earlier, in the Journal of Evangelical Theology, Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society. This is by a gentleman named Benjamin Foreman, who is a professor at John MacArthur's Master Seminary. He says that Naboth was not executed in Jezreel, but rather in Samaria. And he goes, I haven't read the article thoroughly because I am thoroughly up to my eyeballs in this. I will one day. But if he's right, there's a problem with that. Jehu thought that Elijah's prophecy was to be fulfilled in Jezreel. That's why Jehu threw Joram's body into Naboth's vineyard. But if Naboth was executed in Samaria, then Jehu wouldn't be coming close to fulfilling Elijah's prophecy like Jehu claimed he was. So Jehu would really have to be confused about that prophecy. Well, I certainly am not going to make a claim to omniscience on this issue. It's a hard one. I report, you decide. In verse 39, as we move on, now the rest of the acts of Ahab and all that he did and the ivory house which he built. When I read that, I thought of a house made of solid ivory. Well, that can't be. Pulpit commentary says it was called the house of ivory because it was adorned with ivory. Adorned with, ornamented with, decorated with. It would be impossible to make a house of solid ivory, of course. But it was an unusual thing. Beautiful thing, I'm sure. And so it's mentioned here in Kings. Now in verse 39, all the cities which Ahab had built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And that's not the canonical book of Chronicles. That mainly dealt with the south. As John Gill points out, this is not the scriptural book of Chronicles. None of the things just mentioned, like that house of ivory, is mentioned in the canonical book of Chronicles. Verse 40, so Ahab slept with his fathers, that means he died. That was 853 B.C., and Ahaziah took over in 853, the same year that Ahab died, and he ruled for 2 years, 853 to 852. So we go now to verses 41 through 44 of 1 Kings 22. Now Jehoshaphat, the son of Asa, became king over Judah in the fourth year of Ahab, king of Israel. So let's look at the dates. Jehoshaphat reigned from 870 to 848. He was the son of Asa, who ruled from 911 to 870. Jehoshaphat became king over Judah in the fourth year of Ahab. Ahab started his reign in 874. The fourth year would be 870, and that's just when Jehoshaphat took over. Verse 42, Jehoshaphat was 35 years old when he became king, and he reigned 25 years in Jerusalem. Died pretty young. 35 and 25 is what? 60 years old. And his mother's name was Azubah, the daughter of Shilhai. He walked in all the way of Asa his father. He did not turn aside from it, doing right in the sight of the Lord. However, the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places. Jehoshaphat also made peace with the king of Israel. Of course, nothing is known about his mother, Azubah, and his grandmother, Shilhai. What's important is he was a good king. He walked in the ways of his father, Asa. That means he didn't put up idols. However, the high places were not taken away. But 2 Chronicles 17:6 says the high places were taken away. So how do we resolve that? 2 Chronicles 17:6, he, that's Jehoshaphat, took great pride in the ways of the Lord and again removed the high places and the Asherim from Judah. Oh, he removed them in Chronicles, but he kept them in Kings. Well, the answer is, in Chronicles, he's removing the pagan high places. It says right there in the verse, remove the high places and the Asherim. So, you know, the high places, it's implied that the Asherim were the high places. Those are the pagan high places he got rid of. But he didn't take away the high places at which Yahweh was worshipped, the true God. They should have been taken away since the temple had been built. It was illegal, but it was difficult to remove them because they'd been there for a long time and the people were attached to them. And so, okay, we got a little black mark, a little blemish on Jehoshaphat's record. This battle of Ramoth Gilead was also a black mark. So he wasn't perfect, but in the sense of not removing or not putting up idols, he was a good king. That's how you measure good kings in the books of Kings and Chronicles. In verse 44, the text says that Jehoshaphat also made peace with the king of Israel. We just saw that he had made a foray to Ramoth-Gilead with Ahab because he was in alliance with him. Ahaziah, he was at peace with. In fact, he entered into a trade treaty, a shipping treaty with Ahaziah, as we'll see in a minute. So he was basically at peace with the nasty kings of the north. And that was another one of Jehoshaphat's problems. He didn't keep himself separate from people whose company would corrupt his morals and the prosperity of his kingdom. That's a good word for all of you out there who think we need to compromise with everybody and everything so that we can have peace, so we can just reach our hands across the aisle, turn our eyes away from the sins and the degradation of our opponents, and just all get along. We go now to 1 Kings 22, verses 45 through 47. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoshaphat and his might which he showed and how he warred, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? The remnant of the Sodomites who remained in the days of his father Asa he expelled from the land. Now there was no king in Edom, a deputy was king. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoshaphat are written in the book of Chronicles. That's the canonical book of Chronicles, and we're going to go look at what he did. Well, let me just give you a list from Colin Delitzsch of the things that Jehoshaphat did. He raised fortifications. He organized the military force. You can read that in Chronicles. He instructed the people in the law, 2 Chronicles 17:9. They, referring to the Levites, taught throughout Judah, having the book of the Lord's instruction with them. They went throughout the towns of Judah and taught the people. And that's pretty cool, traveling teachers, itinerant teachers. That was to Jehoshaphat's credit. Another thing that Jehoshaphat did, he improved the administration of justice, also recorded in 2 Chronicles, chapter 19, verses 8 through 10. Jehoshaphat also appointed in Jerusalem some of the Levites and priests and some of the heads of the Israelite families for deciding the Lord's will and for settling disputes of the residents of Jerusalem. He commanded them, saying, "In the fear of the Lord, with integrity and with a whole heart, you are to do the following. For every dispute that comes to you from your brothers who dwell in their cities, whether it regards differences of blood guilt, law, commandment, statutes, or judgments, you are to warn them so they will not incur guilt before the Lord, and wrath will not come on you and your brothers. Do this, and you will not incur guilt." So there's a bunch of legal reform there, which warms my heart as an ex-lawyer. Verse 45 says that all these acts of Jehoshaphat are written in the book of Chronicles. As I said, that's the canonical book. Barnes points out that the biographer of Jehoshaphat appears to have been Jehu, the son of Hanani. That would be a prophet Jehu. We read in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 34, "The rest of the events of Jehoshaphat's reign from beginning to end are written in the capital events of Jehu, son of Hanani." So the Holman Christian Study Bible capitalized that book, "The Events of Jehu, son of Hanani," which is recorded in the book of Israel's Kings. So the book of Israel's Kings has been lost, but Jehu must have had a piece in it as he recorded Jehoshaphat's life and deeds. Now again, that's not the Jehu that knocked off Joram that we were just talking about. This is a different Jehu. This is a prophet Jehu. In verse 46, it mentions that Jehoshaphat did another good thing. He expelled the Sodomites from the land. Oh, could we use King Asa? Oh, I might get kicked off of YouTube for saying this. We have guardians of speech now and guardians of our thought in Silicon Valley. And if you say something that might offend somebody, they will take you off of YouTube. Well, this is not on YouTube. They'll take you off of social media. Let's put it that way. I don't know what your podcast will do when I say this, but I hope they will not take this issue down, this down. We need somebody like Asa to expel the Sodomites from the land. Now, these were not just ordinary Sodomites. These were cult prostitutes. We read that Asa did that in 1 Kings 15:12. He, Asa, also put away the male cult prostitutes from the land and removed all the idols which his fathers had made. Now, verse 47 says there was no king in Edom. A deputy was king. Now, why in the world would that be put in there? Edom, of course, is the land south of Israel, between the south of the Dead Sea to the north of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba, in that desert area there, the deserts of Sin and Paran, also a little bit to the east of the Araba Valley there, south of the Dead Sea. That's Edom. Now, there was no king there in Edom. That had been true since the time of David. David had placed governors over Edom, and these governors paid tribute to David, so David was in charge of Edom. That continued all the way through the times of Jehoshaphat. But in the time of Joram, Edom rebelled and set up a king of their own, 2 Kings 8:20. In his, that's Jehoram's, reign, which was 848 to 841, in those days, Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah and made a king over themselves. All right, but that's Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram's. But in Jehoshaphat's time, there was no king. He was in charge of Edom. Now, why is that mentioned? Well, that's to explain how Jehoshaphat could build ships in Ezion Geber, which is in Edom. It's all the way down at the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the branch of the Red Sea that is east of the Suez branch of the Red Sea. It's near present-day Eilat. In fact, many people don't know exactly where Ezion Geber is. It's a port down there. Some people say it's right there at Eilat. The map has it right on top of it almost. So as far as I'm concerned, they're in the same place. So we go now to 1 Kings 22, verses 48 through 50. Jehoshaphat made ships of Tarshish to go to Ophir for gold. But they did not go for the ships. The ships were broken at Ezion Geber. Then Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, said to Jehoshaphat, "Let my servants go with your servants in the ships." Now, Ahaziah had taken over from Ahab in 853, so this is during Ahaziah's short reign, 853 to 852. 852 was about 4 years before Jehoshaphat died. And so Ahaziah says to Jehoshaphat, "Let my servants go with your servants in the ships." Now, of course, the first problem you have there is what ships? They were broken at Ezion Geber. They were shipwrecked, and now Ahaziah wants to serve in the ships. What ships? But Jehoshaphat was not willing. All right, well, let's deal with that problem first. Jehoshaphat made ships of Tarshish. Tarshish is a Sanskrit or Aryan word meaning the seacoast. There can be little doubt, says Easton, although people debate on where it was. Easton says there can be little doubt, however, that this is the name of a Phoenician port in Spain, and that's the way I always take it. Between the two mouths of the Guadalquivir River, it was founded by a Carthaginian colony. And of course, Phoenicia founded Carthage, and Carthage founded Tarshish, and it was the farthest western harbor of Tyrian sailors. Tyre, of course, is in Phoenicia on the Mediterranean coast. It was to this port Jonah's ship was about to sail from Joppa. It has well been styled the Peru of Tyrian adventure. It abounded in gold and silver mines. It appears that this name also was used without reference to any locality. Ships of Tarshish is an expression sometimes denoting simply ships intended for a long voyage. Ships of a large size, seagoing ships, whatever might be the port to which they sailed. So I'm going to say that these ships of Tarshish are just that. It's the name of a class of ships, big, heavy, seagoing ships. This avoids the problem of how did the ships get from Tarshish to Ezion Geber, because the ships would have to sail from Israel all the way to Tarshish, to Spain, past the Rock of Gibraltar, south, around, all the way around the tip of Africa, then back up into the Red Sea, and then up the Gulf of Aqaba to Ezion Geber, and that's a long, long way. So I don't think that's what's meant here. It's just that Jehoshaphat, since he had control of Ezion Geber, because there was no king of Edom there, he was building ships, and then they got broken, probably in a storm, at Ezion Geber. Now, Ezion Geber means giant's backbone. It got its name because they were rocks, probably, because they were rocks that stood up like a man's spine in the harbor. I've been to Eilat right in that same area, and the harbor is very rocky. In fact, you can see rocks running out into the sea, way out into the clear blue sea. You can't go swimming there. You can't just go walking out on the rocks. There's rocks everywhere. And so this giant's backbone, Ezion Geber, somehow probably contributed to the shipwreck of Jehoshaphat's ships. Might have been a big storm, a hurricane, typhoon blows up and smashes the ship against the rocks. Well, now this was a punishment. We go to 2 Chronicles 20, verses 35 through 37. After this, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, allied himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel. He acted wickedly in so doing. So he allied himself with him to make ships to go to Tarshish. And they made the ships in Ezion Geber. Now there, the way it's translated, the ships to go to Tarshish, that sounds like they got to go all the way around south of Africa and back up to Tarshish, which I don't think is impossible, but along the coast. But I'm not going to worry about that. The point is that Jehoshaphat and Ahaziah made an alliance. Verse 37, then Eliezer, the son of Dodavahu of Marishah, sounds Indian almost, then Eliezer prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, "Because you have allied yourself with Ahaziah, the Lord has destroyed your works." So the ships were broken and could not go to Tarshish. So we see that the shipwreck was a result of Jehoshaphat unrighteously allying himself with Ahaziah. So then we run into another problem. Well, we run into a problem. The son of Ahab, that's Ahaziah says to Jehoshaphat, "Let my servants go with your servants in the ships." Well, how could that be? The ships were already wrecked. Well, here's the answer. Probably. Jehoshaphat probably built more ships on his own, and he refused to let Ahaziah have a share in the ownership. So Ahaziah wanted to share in the hopefully profitable trade, and so he says, "Well, let me put some soldiers on there, on your ships. I'll help you. I'll give you some free labor. Just let me share in the profits." Well, whatever the deal was, Jehoshaphat in verse 49 is said to be not willing. He had already been reproved by the prophet Eliezer, who is otherwise unknown as far as I know. He had already lost his ships being in alliance with Ahaziah. Eliezer's prophecy had come true. So why would Jehoshaphat want to ally himself with Ahaziah anymore? Once again, allying a godly man, allying himself with ungodly people, it does not lead to good things. This is a good application point. You want to be in a business partnership with a non-Christian whose morals are suspect, you might as well marry him, because you are in up to your eyeballs. I know people this has happened to when I was practicing law. They wanted to get out. They wanted to dissolve that partnership so bad. They were so sad they ever got into that relationship. So be careful when you go into business partnerships. Barnes agrees with this solution of the problem. Quote, "Ahaziah had thus an interest in the ships, and when they were wrecked, attributing, as it would seem, the calamity to the unskillfulness of his ally, Jehoshaphat's mariners, he proposed that the fleet should be manned in part by Israelite sailors, men probably accustomed to the sea, perhaps trained at Tyre. This proposal Jehoshaphat refused, either offended at the reflection on his subject's skill, or accepting the wreck of the ships, which Eliezer had prophesied, as a proof that God was against the entire undertaking. And so we bid fair adieu to Jehoshaphat." Now let's go back up north and say goodbye to Ahab. He's already been buried, of course. 1 Kings 22:51-53. Ahaziah, again, he ruled from 853 to 852. "Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel and Samaria in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat." If you take 870 and you minus 17 from 870, you get 853, which is the year that Ahaziah took over. And Ahaziah reigned 2 years over Israel, 853 to 852, 2 years. "He did evil. Ahaziah did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father and in the way of his mother and in the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. So he served Baal and worshipped him and provoked the Lord God of Israel to anger according to all that his father had done." Well, it says he's an evil king of the north. Well, that's not surprising. Every last one of the kings of northern Israel were evil, were bad, because they either had Yahweh being worshipped as a golden calf or they had Baal idols, or maybe other idols too. I can't recall off the top of my head, but at least Baal and Asherah idols. And so they were evil, all of them, every last one. Verse 52 says that Ahaziah acted like his father. His father Ahab worshipped Baals, so Ahaziah worshipped Baals. Verse 52 says that Ahaziah walked like his mother walked. His mother was Jezebel, and she worshipped Asherah. So that means that Ahaziah worshipped Asherah. And then in verse 52, it says that Ahaziah walked in the way of Jeroboam. That's the founder of the northern kingdom of Israel. When the kingdom split in 931 B.C., Jeroboam the first, and Jeroboam had set up those golden calves in Dan and Bethel for the Israelites to worship Yahweh with. Well, they're still there because Ahaziah walked in the way of Jeroboam. Ladies and gentlemen, with that sad story, we are now finished with the book of 1 Kings. In our next audio, I'll start with 2 Kings chapter 1. We'll see what's in there when we get there. I hope you enjoyed this audio.